We've been journeying through the Bible together now for about 3 months, and for almost all of that time, we've been with the people of Israel. And then we've learned that the people of Israel were a people of the land, of a particular land that was promised to them. God chose from among all the people of the world one family, the family of Abraham and Sarah, to become God's people. And their descendants, God promised the land to them. And even when they left the land because there was a great famine and they went to Egypt and ended up being enslaved there, God delivered them out of slavery in Egypt and brought them back to that land that was promised to them. And for a while they lived in the land as God had intended, with no king or no queen, no sovereign but God. But eventually the people called for a king, and so they were given one. And Saul and David and Solomon, and then the kingdom was split, north and south. The northern kingdom was conquered a few hundred years later, but the southern kingdom, the kingdom of Judah, that was centered in Jerusalem, lasted for over 400 years. For 400 years, the people had a land that was their own, a land that was home, a land that they had lived in for generation after generation after generation. Our nation is not even 250 years old. And yet we have such strong ties and affection for our country, for our land. Can you imagine 400 years worth of that, plus a divine promise that the land was yours? But in the year 587, the Babylonian Empire came, and they laid siege to Jerusalem. They surrounded the city so that no supplies could come in, no people could leave, and they starved the people out. They tore down the walls. They tore down the temple where they had worshipped for 400 years. And they exiled many of the people. Now, not everyone left, not everyone was sent away, but most of the leaders, most of the people of prominence and wealth were sent to other places, to Babylon in particular. And we hear stories from the Bible of this time. But first, I want us to hear from Jeremiah. Jeremiah was a prophet during this time period. He prophesied in the southern kingdom and warned them that doom was to come because they were being unfaithful to God and they were not loving neighbor as they should. And so when ruin did come, Jeremiah did two things. The first is that Jeremiah bought a field. Now, this is kind of an odd thing, right? Because the land has just been captured by a foreign enemy. Everything that they know, devastation and despair. But in the midst of all of that, when most would say it would be a terrible time to invest in land, Jeremiah buys a field. He buys a field as a sign and as a symbol to give the people hope that this destruction and devastation is not the end of the story. And he takes the deed to the land and he seals it up inside a clay pot so that it will last for a long time. Because he knows, he has faith that in the future, the land will be restored. The people will be allowed to come back and to be part of the land again. A message, a sign, a symbol of hope. Jeremiah also writes a letter to the people who were sent into exile, the people who had to march away from Jerusalem and from Judah into a foreign country. He sends them a letter, and Sarah read a big portion of that letter. And in the letter, Jeremiah tells the people to seek the good of the land where they're going, to settle there, to build homes and live in them, to plant gardens and eat the food from the gardens, to get married, to have children, to have your children get married and have children, to live in that land for generations to come, and to seek its welfare. Now that is quite a change from how the people of Israel have operated before. In many ways, they've set themselves up against people of other lands and other nations. They've seen themselves as different, as distinct, as holy, as separate, as other than people from other nations. And while some of that continues in their practices of following the law and those things, Jeremiah says, don't be so strict about that. Go into this land and be part of the people who are there. Take on some of their customs. Become friends with them. Become family with them. Seek the welfare of the place you are going. Indeed, make this new place home. Make it home. Your home for 400 years has been this land that was promised to you, but now you have a new home. And here's the hope in that. The hope is that in many ways before, God was tied to the land where they lived. In many ways, their theology was that God lived in this land that was promised to them. But now that they're away from that land, God has not abandoned them. God goes with them even to this new place, even to this distant land, even when they are strangers in a strange land, God is with them. And so in the Bible, we hear some stories from this time period. The story of Daniel is probably the most well-known. Daniel was one of the more prominent people who was sent into exile, and so was in the king's court and had certain food and things that he was supposed to do, but decided not to do those, but to remain true to his Jewish identity. Eventually, there was a law passed that everybody would have to bow down and worship this something, and Daniel refused, and so he was thrown into a den of lions, facing certain and sure death, but the lions do not attack Daniel. Similarly, he had three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And they are sentenced in a similar kind of way, but not into a den of lions, but into a fiery furnace. And so they are sent into this furnace, into blazing fire, into sure and certain death, and yet they are not harmed at all by the flames. God is with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. God is with Daniel, even in these foreign lands. Even when change has happened all around them, God is there and present with them. There are other stories in the Bible, many in the Apocrypha in particular from this time period, but I want us to turn to the story of Esther. Now, Esther actually happens after the period of the exile in the year, I think it's 539. Cyrus is the new emperor of the day, and he proclaims this edict that says people can now return back to Jerusalem and to Israel. And so this happens a little bit after that, but it's still set outside of the land that was promised to the people. And so I think it fits with this idea of the exile, of being somewhere else, of not being where you are, where you've known and what's you might be home. So we turn to Esther, and there are four main characters in Esther. The first is King Ahasuerus, and that's the Hebrew word for his name, and so we're not quite sure exactly which king this is. Most scholars say that it's King Xerxes of the Persian Empire, but some say Artaxerxes, and a few others are put out there. But in the end, I'm not sure it really matters which historical king it is. But the main thing is that there is a king. And then the second character is Esther, who becomes his queen. And Esther is Jewish. But she's a Jew in secret. She doesn't make that known to the king or to others. The third character in the story is Mordecai, who is related somehow to Esther. The word in Hebrew can mean a few different things. He might be your uncle, might be your cousin, but it's clear that he's older and has cared for her. He's not her father, but he's kind of raised her as his own daughter. And then the fourth character is Haman, and he is an official in the king's court. And so let me tell you the story of Esther. King Ahasuerus was married to a queen, Vashti was her name, and he became angry with her. She wouldn't follow his instructions and do exactly what he wanted, and so he said, I need a new queen. And so he holds almost like this beauty pageant contest. And all these women from all over the lands are called, and they come before him, and he chooses the one that he thinks is the most fitting queen. And of all the women who come, he chooses Esther. Esther, this woman who is a Jew but in secret. Now, soon after this, Mordecai discovers that there is a plot against the king. that some of the officials within the king's court are attempting to assassinate him. And so Mordecai reports this, and the people are arrested, and they're put in jail, and the king's life is saved. And so it's recorded in this book. I don't know the name of the book, but this book that the king has that records all the things that were important during his reign. And then we come to the other character of Haman. Haman was an official in the king's court, and after all this kind of turmoil and stuff within the court, Haman gets promoted to be the top official within the court. Basically, he's second in command in all of the empire and all of the kingdom. And so he thinks of himself in pretty high terms. And so he wants others to bow down to him whenever he walks by. And in fact, most people do. When he walks by, people bow down and they not worship him so much, but they bow down before him. They respect him. But Mordecai refuses to do this. Mordecai believes that one should only bow down and worship God and certainly not a human being. And so Mordecai refuses, and Haman is incensed. And so that's the story that the passage that Sarah read for us. Haman is so upset that he wants to kill Mordecai, but even more than that, he's so angry that he wants to kill all of Mordecai's people. And so he discovers that Mordecai is a Jew. And so Haman works behind the scenes to get a law passed that on this particular day, all the Jews in the kingdom are fair game to be killed. If anybody wants to, they can kill someone who is a Jew. Now Mordecai and others find out about this, and they are as upset as you can possibly imagine, but this law has been passed by the king, and so there's really nothing that they can do. They feel hopeless. But Mordecai goes to Esther, the queen, who, like anyone else, is only allowed into the king's presence in the court if she is invited. And Mordecai says to Esther, "You've got to do something. Our people are in danger. Our people are going to be killed. We're going to be wiped off the face of the earth. I need you to do something." And Esther says, "I can't go into the king's court and ask anything of him. It's against the law. If I do, he might have me killed." And Mordecai says, "If you don't do it, then somebody else will. God will find a way, but maybe, just maybe, you've been put in this place for this particular reason. Won't you go and ask for help? Won't you rescue our people?" And so Esther decides that she will. She works up the courage and she walks into the king's court, and there's this moment of, what is the king going to do? Is he going to accept her and listen to her? Is he going to have her killed just like he rejected the queen before, Esther? And the king allows her to come in and listens to her. And she makes a request. The request is that the king and Haman would come to a banquet that she's going to throw. And the king is excited about this. Free food, wonderful stuff, it's going to be great. Haman is particularly excited about it as well. He, of course, is all puffed up and everything and thinks that this is showing that he's the greatest of all. That night, though, before the banquet, the king is having a little trouble sleeping. He can't fall asleep, and so he asks for that book to come out and be read, that book that records the important things in his kingdom. Apparently, these must have been kind of boring things, so that might help him sleep. And so the officials start reading some of the things that have happened, and there's this story of Mordecai uncovering this assassination plot and saving the king. And the king asks, whatever happened to this Mordecai? Did we do anything to celebrate or to reward him? And there's nothing recorded. And so the king begins to wonder, well, what can we do to thank this man Mordecai for all that he has done? And so he invites Haman to come and ask him a question. He asks him, well, if someone has done something so great, if they've been wonderful to me, well, what should we do to celebrate this person? Haman, of course, thinks that the king is referring to him. He's the top official in the land. He's done all this work for the king. The king must want to reward him in some kind of way. And so Haman says, oh, well, we've got to do it upright. We've got to put a wonderful robe on this person and put them on a horse and lead them through the village and have everybody celebrate and do all these wonderful things for this person to celebrate. And the king says, all that sounds wonderful. I want you to do that for Mordecai. Oh, Haman is so mad about this, right? This man that he hates, this man that he despises, this man that he wants his entire people wiped off the face of the earth, he now has to do all these wonderful things for Mordecai. Meanwhile, Haman had been plotting against Mordecai, and that day was approaching where the Jews could be killed, and he'd built gallows for Mordecai to make an example of him in the city. Well, he leads them around through the town, and everybody celebrates Mordecai and gives thanks, and then it's time for the banquet that Esther is to throw. And at this banquet, it is clear that something is bothering Esther, and so the king asks her, what is going on? What's going on with you? What's the issue? And she says, someone is plotting against me and my people. And the king is outraged. He's incensed. He doesn't know what to do. He says, tell me, who is it? And we will certainly dispose of this person. And there Haman sits at the banquet. And she says, it's him. It's Haman. He's trying to kill me and kill all of my people. So the king says, well, his fate shall be the fate that he had for you. And so he takes Haman and hangs him on the gallows that had been prepared for Mordecai. And on the day when the day comes when the Jews were supposed to be killed, they are allowed to kill whoever they want. I'm not quite sure how to make sense of that, but there you go. Something about justice and fair play and everything else. But the main point is that the people were saved because Esther had the courage to stand up. She had the courage to ask. And so in the end, I'm left with the story, and I'm left with this idea of exile. In many ways, we live in a similar kind of world. Sure, our land has not been conquered by someone else. We've not been sent into a foreign place, but changes are happening all around us. In many ways, the world that we live in now doesn't feel like the world that we used to know. I know that's especially true here in the United Methodist Church. Changes and anxiety and everything all around. And so how are we called to live in a world like this? How are we called to live as strangers in a strange land? I think we can take a cue from Jeremiah, that we can offer hope, and that we can seek the good of the world in which we find ourselves. It doesn't do much good to lament the past. Sure, sometimes we need to do that. But I think it makes more sense to accept our present reality and to seek good in it. And then I think we can also take a page from Esther. That we can be faithful to who we are, to God, to our people, and we can have courage. We can remain true. Despite all the changes around us, despite all the messages that we receive, we can be faithful and true. Because the exile, if it doesn't show us anything else, it shows us that God is faithful wherever we go. Whatever circumstances we find ourselves in, God is faithful to us and is with us. And so we can have that trust, and we can have that hope. And whatever it is we face with God. May we be true. May we be courageous. May we be brave like Esther. Amen.